Hi, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Gwenda Tavan, an associate professor in politics at La Trobe University. Gwenda is known as one of Australia's foremost experts in the history and politics of immigration and multiculturalism. Her first book, called The Long Slow Death of White Australia, was an award-winning history of the gradual erosion of the White Australia policy during the decades after World War II. Her new project is a biography of Labor politician Arthur Calwell, who is today remembered as the architect of Australia's pioneering post-war immigration scheme. Gwenda, welcome to Archive Fever, or Archives Anonymous, as we like to call it.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Gwenda, we'll get back to Calwell and his archives shortly, but I'd like to start by going back to the beginning and asking if you can first remember when you got the research bug. When did the addiction first strike?
That's an easy question. It was my honours year. I was doing joint honours at La Trobe in history and politics, and Richard Broome was one of my supervisors, and he suggested that I do a project on the displaced persons scheme that was set up by Calwell in 1947. And that meant that I had to go up to Canberra, the National Archives, to have a look at some files on the selling of the campaign for the displaced persons program. So I can remember this very well. I caught the bus up to Canberra and I thought, where the hell am I? It was cold and lonely and Canberra looked like a very isolated place. This was in the early 90s. Anyway, I hit the National Archives the next day and it was just like finding treasure. That was my first introduction. I started looking at all these Department of Immigration files and I was looking very closely at the publicity around the displaced person scheme. This is where Calwell came up with this idea of the beautiful bolts. So to sell the scheme, they had to convince Australians that the displaced persons coming from the Baltic states were just like us, blonde, fair, hardworking. I was hooked. From the get-go, it was really incredibly powerful. I did a pretty good job with that honours thesis, and that was it. I think that set me up for a project that is still ongoing.
And what does it feel like for you to be hooked into the archives? What does your kind of personal archive fever look like?
I'd like to say that I am a very systematic person when it comes to that process of archival research. But the fact of the matter is, because I'm so passionate about it and because I was from a very early time aware of the fact that you never know what you're going to find, you know, and it is like detective work. It's basically dipping in, you know, so some people are very targeted and focused. My approach has always been to kind of keep my research in the archives as open as possible because I want to be open to the possibility that there are things in there that I don't know about. I'm a little bit like a kid with a lolly jar, I guess, going in there and just trying to consume as much as possible. And that means I tend to probably over-research if I think about all the different projects that I've worked on. But I think the payoff for that has been that very often my archival research takes me places that I did not expect to go. And some of my most joyous moments have been discovering those little gems that, really kind of upend your own view of what's happening in the past.
Gwenda, Jacques Derrida, who coined the phrase archive fever, so he's kind of like the patron saint of our podcast, he called archival work a kind of a homecoming. Now, you're a historian of migration who also comes from a migrant family, with your parents migrating from Southern Europe after World War II. How do you reckon your personal migrant history shaped your relationship to migration archives? Is there a kind of a homecoming for you there?
Oh, definitely. I think that my whole research career, all the questions that I've asked about Australian society and history have been profoundly shaped by my own personal experiences and really trying to make sense of the historical context, the national and cultural context in which I found myself as a child growing up. I think migrant kids, kids from minority groups, kids who are on the receiving end of racism, very often become close observers of the society around them. You know, how did I end up here? Why did my parents end up here? What was the context in which they came, the policy context? So in a sense, yes, it has been about a homecoming because it's been about a way of trying to explain these broad historical forces that influenced myself and my family, but also everyone around me.
I believe that you previously described yourself as an addict of the migration collections at the National Archives of Australia. What do you find so alluring about these materials? What kind of drives that addiction?
Well, as I said, it's the thing about trying to piece together a story. I think of archival research as detective work. Mm. You know, it's very different from desktop research. It's actually being open to that idea that you don't know the whole story and that you're trying to piece together a process. Also, most of my work has been focused on, you know, the role of the state, policymakers, politicians and bureaucrats and how they make decisions around immigration. And so it's been incredibly important, I think, to be able to access the thinking, the ideas, and to trace the processes that constitute a policy decision and its aftermath, right? It doesn't sound very exciting to talk about public policy and public administration, but the bottom line is that the migration experience and the shaping of Australia post-war society was on the back of decisions that were made by people in power. So trying to understand that and coming to terms with the complexity of political decision making is what drives me. And I find it quite fascinating because what is very clear is what politicians and bureaucrats think they're doing when they make a decision is based on the information they have to hand. And very often you, by tracing through the archives, come to see outcomes can be very different because of external factors or, you know, other political factors that come into play. So I find that really addictive.
Gwenda, that's a very intellectual journey that the archives take you on. Clearly, you're answering questions that feed your curiosity about where you and other people have come from and about the context in which they arrive and how they've been brought. And that all makes sense because you're a scholar, you're an academic.
Yep.
But apart from the intellectual drive, do you find a kind of emotional comfort in archives?
That is true. And it goes without saying that I gave you the intellectual response first. It does because we're talking about human beings making decisions that have human consequences and in which I feel personally invested emotionally. Many of the decisions that I'm looking at in a public policy context are decisions that impacted on me very directly. So I'm very struck by that. Even when you're dealing with politicians and bureaucrats who make difficult decisions that you realise have adverse consequences, working through this sort of material, you come face to face with their humanity, even when they're making decisions that you know are not going to work out. But most of all, of course, is when you come face to face with the real dramatic human consequences of those decisions. I've written a couple of pieces that involved cases in which immigrants to Australia were really harshly treated by the immigration department and by political leaders. And when you come across those sorts of cases, you're having to deal with the human consequences. And that is profoundly moving. I feel privileged by the ability to access that. And, you know, it can shape people's lives. I wonder if I could give you an example. While I was doing my PhD, which became the book, The Long Slow Death of White Australia, I came across a case involving little Nancy Prasad. And Nancy's family were deported from Australia. They were Indian Fijian. And even though they had two family members living in Australia, the family were visa overstayers and they were deported. Nancy was 5 or 6 at the time. We're talking about the mid-1960s. And she couldn't be deported with her family because she had a throat infection. There was a huge international controversy about the Immigration Department's pursuit of Nancy Prasad to have her deported. And she was finally deported. Before they got her on the plane, she was abducted from Mascot Airport by Indigenous and student activists protesting against the White Australia policy. It was a setup. It was basically trying to draw public attention to the case. It was such a fascinating case. And the more I delved into it as part of my research for my monograph, the more I realised that there was a very important story to be told. I started to collect all the information I could find on the Prasads. The story itself was incredibly poignant. I set up an interview with Nancy many years later, and I went to meet her at her home. I went up with all of the archival material that I had found. When she opened the door, I handed her the material, and she had never seen any of this information. It was a really profoundly moving moment for me. It was almost kind of scary, actually, because I realised that as an archivist, as a historian, I had a power and access that was both wonderful but frightening because, you know, basically all this information I had was about Nancy and her family. She didn't even know it existed. It was a really telling moment for me about the power of what I do and what other archivists do, but also the responsibility because, you know, this case was very fraught. It was very complex and it was about Nancy's own family. So I learned a lot from that, but actually made me feel quite humbled, kind of reinforced my commitment to doing this. There's a lot of power, there's a lot of truth that comes through archives, and that is incredibly emotionally rewarding.
And holders of family archives can use and wield that power. I believe you've been on the other end of that in terms of your Corwell research. Can you tell us a little bit about the Corwell archive?
Arthur Corwell, who I've been working on a partial biography of him for more years than I care to remember now, his papers are held by the National Library of Australia. And his daughter, Mary Elizabeth, has had very strong control over those papers for a very long time. I was very fortunate because she gave me access to those papers when I was writing my honours thesis. I had written to her asking, could I access the Corwell papers for my honours thesis? And she gave me open-ended access. And I was allowed to keep that access when others couldn't have it. Now, that's been amazing. I think it's a terrific collection. But Mary Elizabeth is a very staunch defender of her father's legacy, and that has meant having to negotiate with her constantly about keeping that access. I do understand in many ways because I think her father is in fact a very misunderstood figure and why she should want to defend at least aspects of his legacy. But it does mean that I over the years have had to have this constant discussion with her about keeping that access and having to kind of reassure her that I mean no harm to her father's legacy. And I have to balance that with the integrity required to do what I do, which is to say, I have to write this and interpret this material as I see fit. So that has been fraught at times, and it sometimes involved me having to be very firm with her. Fortunately, I think over the years, she has developed some trust. But yes, it certainly was a lesson for me in managing those tricky family relations.
Because Caldwell, as you've said, is remembered as being a very divisive, a controversial figure, someone who, you know, on the one hand opened up Australia to immigration from Europe for the first time, but also was a great proponent of white Australia. And, you know, many people would probably call him a racist, really. I'm interested in the process of getting to know Caldwell really deeply through being immersed in his archives and writing the biography. How has your relationship with him kind of changed over the years you've been researching him, and how do you feel about him at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when I started all this research, I had a fixed view about the racism of Australian immigration policy, obviously and most self-evidently in relation to Indigenous Australians and non-Europeans. And certainly when I did that first honours thesis research on the displaced persons, I was very, very sensitive to racialised implications of that propaganda campaign around the displaced persons, you know, focusing on blonde, Anglo-looking people, etc. So that was my introduction. Over the years, I've come to change my views, or at least come to terms with the complexity of the thinking behind Caldwell's views of the post-war immigration program, but also that program as a whole. This is the wonderful thing about archival research because, again, if you're doing it properly, I think you're keeping an open mind. You are discovering pieces of the puzzle that require you to take account of those things. So over the years, for example, I've come to see that Arthur Caldwell was a very staunch defender of the White Australia policy, but he also maintained very good close connections with a variety of migrant communities in Australia, including the Jewish community, the Italian community, and the Chinese community. He was also a defender of Indigenous rights, or Aboriginal rights, as he would have said then. Discovering this through my research showed me that there was complexity to this man, much more than we'd allowed for or credited him for. The other thing is that as I've continued my work on Caldwell and the Immigration Department as a whole, I've come to realise that, in fact, there's a powerful force of politicians which is about having to balance political interests. We have a very strong perception that, and sometimes rightly so, that what people do in political decision-making processes reflects their value system as a whole. But of course, in liberal democracies, decision making is always about balancing interests. Now, in the case of Caldwell and the White Australia policy, he was a very staunch defender of it and unapologetic in that respect. But it's also very clear that he had to weigh up the political interests involved in terms of implementing a program that politically was very sensitive. So he was making decisions that always had an eye on keeping and protecting the post-war immigration policy. And that was in relation to the White Australia policy, but it was also, for example, evident in the decision to put quotas on the number of Jewish refugees travelling to Australia. We find the thought of that really offensive nowadays. In the political context of those times, they thought that that was the best way of protecting the post-war immigration program as a whole. You know, I do feel like I've come to see much more complexity in his thinking over time. And in terms of the biographical work, as I've moved through his career, you know, and he stopped being immigration minister in 49, then the human aspect of the story, the kind of psychological motivations of an aging man trying to come to terms with a dramatically changing society has come much more to the fore for me.
And tell us about the kind of materials that are actually in the archives that are allowing you to see this three-dimensional picture. I mean, yeah. Is it mainly documents about Caldwell's political career, or are there personal letters, kind of revealing diaries or okay. things like that?
Caldwell's fascinating because he was incredibly well-read, but he wasn't really given to self-introspection. He regarded himself as a very moral, ethical person who lived by a very clear set of principles and values. So what you get in his collection is a lot of information about what he did. There's a lot of correspondence, there's all his speeches, there's a lot of family history stuff. But what you don't get is any sense, like through a diary, for example, of introspection or self-questioning. So really, part of my task, and this is why it's taking me so long, is to try to piece together a sense of his internal world, his emotional world, through a set of documents that are really, in many ways, a public record of what he did. And in that respect, very often one has to read between the lines. Interestingly, Caldwell's own, you know, his autobiography has been very important for me in that respect. There's a lot in there that hints at the kinds of psychological processes and the personality profile that he was working with.
Gwen, did you have to show Mary Elizabeth a draft of the book? That part of the contract?
No, I don't. I would never have allowed that to happen. Again, it's that thing about one drawing one's own boundaries. I have said to her over, you know, numerous occasions, she has to trust me to do the best I can with the material I've got. And she has to trust me as an historian to make, you know, the right judgments about
it. It's a huge responsibility.
It is a huge responsibility, and I hope I'm fulfilling that. I wrote and published a short article on Caldwell as a paradoxical leader a few years ago, and she wasn't happy with it. I took a kind of psychosocial approach to it. She, I think, didn't particularly like it or agree with it. But having said that, she didn't remove my access to the papers. So again, I feel like we've developed a relationship.
So Gwenda, I'd now like to ask you a question we ask all our guests, which is that, do you have a little dirty archive secret? Something you're a bit kind of uncomfortable admitting about your relationship to archives?
We did say it's Archive Anonymous. It's a safe space.
I mentioned the Nancy Prasad case before when I talked about that. It's not really a secret, but, you know, I talked about the, you know, the shock and the sense of responsibility that I had when I handed over these documents to her. It was both an empowering and very deeply unsettling moment for me. I think that that if I was in the same situation again, you know, ultimately Nancy was very grateful to have access to those papers, but I think it's taught me to be very careful about this power that we have. So it's not a secret so much as a kind of, I guess, a lesson that I've learnt. We have to do this with joy and passion and a sense of how powerful and politically powerful this stuff can be. It's people's lives. And it was only in the handing over of all these documents that I realised the power that I had.
And how did Nancy feel about the article you wrote about her case?
She was really happy, but it was a very big thing because there were parts of that family history that even her children didn't know about. I tried to be incredibly respectful of her boundaries because there was some really important stuff in the archives, including the fact that her family were being followed by immigration officials and in Fiji, and there was a lot of family stuff. She was incredibly grateful, but she was also shocked to realise that there was all this information. I reassured her that I would never publish anything without her agreement, and that was very important in terms of that relationship of trust. Ultimately, I was very proud of how I handled that and the fact that we were able to work through this quite complex issue. But yeah, it was very powerful.
And the final question I'd like to ask, Gwenda, is what archives are you heading to next? After the Caldwell project's finished, do you have a next project or a next archives in mind?
My passion and excitement about the archives is such that I've always got too many projects on the go. So when I started with Caldwell, I had to deal with the Department of Immigration files. And that really reinforced to me something that I had known and kind of suspected for a long time, and that is that we need a good history of the Department of Immigration. I got a fellowship in 2012 to work on the establishment of the department. So I've done some work on that. And I want to continue with that because I think it's a very, very important story to be told. It's even more important nowadays because the Department of Immigration, as it was conceptualized in the 1940s, was a nation-building department. Its plan, its program, its vision was about building Australia. Immigration decision-making today is very, very different. It's about control and compliance. And yes, those immigration functions still hold sway, but they have much less influence in terms of public understanding and policy decision making. So the fact that immigration has been swallowed up in the Department of Home Affairs tells us something really powerful about changing national priorities, changing political priorities. And one of the reasons this has happened with barely, it seems to me, a blink from the public is that we don't understand the significance of what was created in the 1940s when the Chifley Labor government pursued this extraordinary program, this nation-building program to bring people first from Britain and then from Europe, but then gradually from around the world. It's an extraordinary story and it's one that needs to be told.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Archive Fever, Gwenda. It's been an absolute pleasure to share your archival journey with you.
Thank you.
And to learn more about Gwenda's work, you can look at her academic profile on the La Trobe University website. So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
Coming up on the next episode.
I think when you're writing fiction, you want enough to be teased into a story, but not enough that there's fights over the truth. I'm interested in what I can plausibly convey to a reader and they will accept without having that jarring feeling that we've all felt when you're reading a book and you think, hang on, is that possible?